Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Living Stone, a podcast of Greystone Baptist, physically located in Raleigh, North Carolina, recently located everywhere online at greystonechurch.org. We're becoming a digital church, just like every other church right now in this pandemic, aren't we, Steve?
That's exactly right.
Well, I'm Pastor Chrissy. I'm the senior pastor here, and I'm here with my friend Steve, who is on staff, and he is a longtime member here. And we are continuing our conversation of Joan Chittister's book called Scarred by Struggle, Transformed by Hope. Today we plan to talk about the first part of the book. She spends her first couple of chapters setting up the framework for the book, describing struggle, situating it within the Jacob wrestling story from Genesis. And she kind of uses three chapters at the beginning to introduce what she calls a paradigm of struggle. And so we're going to talk a little bit about those introductory chapters. And then we're going to shift to two dyads, which I think are really important for us today. She spends most of the book pairing a specific struggle with something that she calls a gift. And so we'll see lists, or we'll see things like the struggle of isolation and the gift of independence, the struggle of fear and the gift of courage, and so on and so forth. And so today, for our conversation, we're going to focus on those introductory chapters and then the first pair, the struggle of isolation and the gift of independence. And Steve, there were some pieces of those beginning chapters that really spoke to you. And so I want to give you a chance just to tell us what spoke to you and what you're thinking as we wrestle with this today.
Okay. Well, in the first chapter, A Paradigm of Struggle, I kind of went back to this after reading the whole book. And some of the things that she says in this early part of the book just help undergird everything else she's saying throughout this. There's one powerful image in this passage I'm going to read to you, which is on the very first page. Quote, however hard I strive to prove it otherwise, I know that there is no such thing as life without struggle. I have met it, indeed, from one end of life to the other. Over and over again, the foundations of life have shifted and slid away from me, sometimes changing the mental landscape only a little, other times shattering every given I've ever assumed into a kaleidoscope of pain. Unquote. I like the kaleidoscope of pain. That's a very nice poetic image, and it just talks about the complexities and variables of pain and anguish that we suffer when we go through change and struggle and conflict. But the other important image there that she uses kind of throughout the book is how the foundations shift under you, mm-hmm. sort of like an earthquake or a tremor. Everything is reshaped as we go through a big change that is thrust upon us.
Mm-hmm.
The example being the COVID-19 pandemic that we're facing now might be an example of that.
Yeah.
But it's true for every conflict or struggle one faces throughout life. A sudden loss, a death of a loved one, a loss of a job, a divorce, any kind of pain that you suffer, your foundations do change.
Mm-hmm.
Another paragraph from that early chapter, which is on page two, quote, life forges us in struggle. From one end of life to another, we duel and joust, contest and dispute, rebel and revolt, against forces outside ourselves, yes, but against tensions within us as well. We struggle from infancy in an attempt to exert our own will on the world around us, only to discover that we are pinioned in our efforts by the equally strong wills of those around us. We find ourselves pitted against forces of our own making and against forces beyond the edges of our understanding, greater than the limits of our strength to repel.
Mm.
And then one of the other ones that I really liked was the paragraph at the beginning of chapter two, which is the loss of certainty. And Joan Chittister makes a reference to the postmodern world that we live in, the skepticism, the whole postmodern movement that began in her lifetime, which I think she was born in the 30s, mm-hmm. I believe. And some of those things she experienced, you know, we were talking about World War II, the Holocaust, the Korean War, and then about the time I was coming into being, the early 50s, that some of us remember those times where we were emerging from post-World War II into a time of relative, actually great prosperity, and lots of assurances from, you know, our leaders, and that everything is pretty cool. It's everything's stable and the world is stabilizing and getting better. And we have the promise of prosperity. So this is her reflection, quote, "But like most people, I was raised on absolutes and categories, on rules and certainties. I was told that my destiny was in my hands. If I worked hard, I would succeed. If I lived a good life, I would be rewarded. If I prayed hard enough, worked long enough, lived a regulated enough life, God would help me and guide me and work life in my favor. But the absolutes faded, the rules changed, even my image of God became bigger than the little tribal, national, male idol who cared only for white North Americans. Now I have come to see little, if anything, is expected to last. All the givens have changed and all the rules with them."
Mm. Yes. Wow. So you have named so many global struggles, and I mean global geographically, but also as universal to the human experience. And I want to go back to the very first one, the kaleidoscope of pain, because I think right now that is a great image for what we are dealing with individually as people who are living under a stay-at-home order, which was lifted last weekend. But there's still a lot of fear about getting out. All of us are asking the questions, is it safe for me to show up here? And how is it safe for me to show up here? And we feel isolated, you know, behind our masks when we go out in public, even though we know that that's the right thing to do. It's a compassionate way to engage in community. But it hides, you know, 70% of our face. And we're not used to that. And so it can be an isolating thing not to be able to read the expression of a neighbor, not to be able to express ourselves with a smile.
Exactly.
You know, so there are so many different layers, and for some reason, when you said the kaleidoscope of pain, it spoke to me in a way that I didn't even notice it when I read that chapter.
Right.
It's not one of my underlines, but it's so true, because as a pastor, I get to know how people are suffering, probably more than most people, maybe bartenders,
right.
Bartenders and pastors. We know how our That's people right. are suffering, right? Because they feel like they can talk to us, And there are so many, there's like a carpet underneath all of us right now, which is COVID-19. And that's like, that's enough stress. We don't need any more change.
Right.
And then there's the, you know, believe it or not, like people are still getting divorces right now. Like that pain is still raw. Relationships are still ending. People are still suffering and dying. And they're doing it alone because people, you know, we can't visit in the hospital. We can't go to the retirement community. We can't sit vigil with our loved ones in their last moments. And so there's even new grief on top of the regular grief, which is happening on top of the carpet of the grief of COVID-19.
Right.
And for each of us, just like when you look in a kaleidoscope, the shapes and the colors are different, but they're moving around and colliding in different moments in time. And we're going to get to isolation later, but just the uniqueness of that sight, like of those particular colors and shapes and collisions that each of us are carrying, makes us isolated in our own little sphere of pain. And that, I mean, I hadn't remembered the image. I hadn't thought about the image, but wow, it's so appropriate for where we are today.
Yeah, this is an aside. When I was chair of the diaconate several years back, and my parting gift was a kaleidoscope, interestingly enough. And it was one that turned, and it was a beautiful gift. I have it on the shelf and I don't pull it down often, but I think of a kid looking through a kaleidoscope and you keep turning it and turning it, and everything is random and nothing's ever quite the same again, sort of like snowflakes.
Yeah.
It's constantly changing.
Yeah.
And that's the constant message throughout this book.
That's right.
Change is afoot all the time. Everything is in a state of flux and
that's
there
right.
are no absolutes.
Well, one of the things that you said also, when you were kind of setting the stage for the book, thanks for doing that. Was you mentioned her words about the foundation shaking. And it reminded me of a book, a collection of sermons by Paul Tillich, who wrote in the mid-20th century, theologian at Union Seminary in New York, among other places. But Tillich's collection of sermons, he writes in the aftermath of World War II. And there's one really famous sermon called the shaking of the foundations, which the book is named after. But he's walking through the decimation of Europe post-war, standing on the rubble, looking around, recognizing that the whole world has changed. Life on this planet is different, and no one will ever be the same again. And he writes so beautifully out of that. I pulled that book with this one when I was grabbing my books for stay at home.
Right.
But it just, to me, there was a collective experience of devastation after World War II. When I read about it, when I hear stories about it, I wasn't alive then, but it feels to me like a moment in history in which everyone and every system had to say, wow, nothing will ever be the same again. And we talked a little bit about when we were brainstorming about this podcast, you know, we talked about some of the institutional changes that happened. And, you know, I can speak to some of those in theology and in church life, and you named some others. And so I wonder if we might talk a little bit about that thing, which we call postmodernity, and how that kind of shows up in every different avenue. Because I think that we're in one of those moments now as a world.
Right. Well, I think postmodernism began as early as the 1940s, but probably kicked into gear in the 50s, late 50s and early 60s, certainly, with a lot of art movements and philosophy and other things that were going on at the time. And I use this analogy. I was a baby boomer, and I started watching things like Leave It to Beaver and Andy Griffith when I was a child, you know, black and white on our old black and white television before we got a color one. And not too long after that, we had footage of the Vietnam War in our living rooms and things that were shocking us. I was born in the time of Eisenhower and prosperity post-World War II, and everything was kind of peaceful. And then Kennedy and Johnson and then Nixon in the 60s, and things started to shake loose a whole lot differently, all the protesting and everything. And as a teenager during those times and emerging from the 60s into the early 70s, it was just a very unsettled time. So that postmodern skepticism just questioned a lot of what, I mean, the young people my age were protesting and questioning a lot of the values that their parents had thrust upon them.
Mm-hmm.
Even things like church. What are the absolutes? What's really important? And then we started really kind of reshaping truth for ourselves, that maybe there's no such thing as absolute ideologies that are going to sustain and last for time. And that's kind of what we were experiencing back then.
Yeah. Well, and I think if you take a bigger look at all of history, there are probably waves of absolutism and a rejection of absolutism. But I don't even know if those are the right words to use. But I think that a small example of that is if you look at Christianity in particular. I'll stay in my lane.
Right.
If you look at Christianity between maybe say 1920 and 2020, there have been waves of more openness and then a closed offness, and it's like a slinky or an accordion, right? Mm-hmm. It opens and then closes and opens and closes. And kind of depending on where you're born and what's happening in the world and where your parents land in that, I think each of us kind of have different experiences of how that original kind of container of our lives is formed. And, I'm 35 now. I was born in the 80s. Reagan was president. A lot of conservatism happening in the world. And I think I was kind of, that was my original foundation, Southern Baptist life kind of at its height, just before kind of what moderate progressives call the takeover in the Southern Baptist seminaries, right? Which I think is a reaction to this questioning of absolutism. There are a lot more layers to it than that, but for today's conversation, I think it's interesting to talk about, when we're faced with crisis, ideological, or a global pandemic or a world war, we have to choose how we're going to respond.
Right.
And Chittister talks a little bit about that when actually on page 9, the next page after what you read about certainty and the loss thereof, she says at the very bottom of 9, to resolve the tension that comes with ethical confusion, with political conflict, with theologies of domination, some people cleave to the past even more tightly than before. Others put down the past entirely and take up little or nothing to take its place. but most of us simply go on trying to find some point of meaning between the two.
Right.
I think, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, when we get to the chapter on the gift of independence, she describes that kind of flow again. And she talks about how there was a point in time in which everything truly was black and white, not just the TV,
right?
Theology, yeah. You know, ethics, mm-hmm. It's right and wrong. And it applies unilaterally in every situation. You know, what I say is right. What I say is wrong is wrong. And anybody who wants to argue is wrong.
Right.
Yeah. So the world is black and white. But then crisis comes and you have to reckon with the fact that things are truly not black and white.
Right. That reference, I like that part. In fact, that was one that I hadn't highlighted, ironically. When you talk about people clinging to the past more tightly before, people want assurance. They want to cling to something solid. And that's one of the undergirding things in this book also. We have one sure place that we can land our feet on that's kind of solid for a while, but change happens, and we have to necessarily move to another place, find our feet again, so to speak, on another foundation. And that's a powerful image too.
Well, one of the things that that came up kind of through the words, you know, we read between the lines, we bring our own experience to the books that we're reading. When I was rereading the chapter on isolation early this morning, what spoke to me is that none of us are made for isolation. Humans are made for community, for relationship, and it's healthy for us psychologically and spiritually to have others around us who stretch us and who challenge us to say, well, that's not my experience. Let's lean into that dissonance there and see where we are. But she talks about how our struggles can be deeply personal, and the impact of our struggles and the meaning that we make from them is utterly public, because we take our struggles and hurl them back into the world. We layer them over. Say we've been in abusive relationships, right? We take that pain and we push it onto the next relationship, and that things kind of become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Or oftentimes in the church, say we've been rejected by the absolutism of the church in the past, and so we assume that all churches and all Christians are like that. And so we let these scabs kind of form on our bodies that prevent us from being able to engage in real relationships and faith communities.
Since we're talking about struggle, you want to jump to the beginning of that chapter?
Let's do it.
On isolation?
Yeah.
This is the opening paragraph speaks very well to this. Quote, struggle is a very private thing. It happens in the very depths of our souls. It comes with the loss of what we have thought to be of such significance that we cannot abide the thought of life without it. Other people commiserate, of course, as they watch us struggle with the pain of losing, the meaning of endings, the shock of great change, the emptiness of the present. But they cannot really share our pain, because what we have lost, however significant to us, is not really significant to them. What we lose is ours and ours alone. Our dream, our hope, our expectation, our property, our identity. All private, all personal, all uniquely and singularly ours.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that's kind of a scary thought. I mean, because we in the midst of the pandemic, the isolation, we're used to frequent interaction. Even our families, we're not getting together like we used to.
Right.
I can't visit my mother in assisted living as freely as I used to. So those interactions, even if we're looking for sustaining relationships to help us get through, they're not assured anymore. But ultimately, we do. And she talks about the shrinking of the psyche, and isolation shrinks the psyche in
Absolutely.
A kind of way. It makes us shrivel down, maybe become self-protective in some ways, because we want some assurance. We can't have those things that we normally connect with. It becomes a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm. There's a pastoral care scholar who talks about the web of connectivity. And if you can imagine a spider web, each of us is a point on that web. And we know what happens if you pull a string on one side, the whole thing rattles, if not falls apart. But when we're in isolation, we're not connected to that web anymore. And so a lot of times, if our string happens to be the one that is pulled, it feels like the whole world is breaking down. And we don't have the benefit of clinging to another intersection or another person's web, you know, to be a lifeline to pull us out of our own devastation. I remember when we first, when the church March 12th made the decision to go online for worship services, we made that decision based on some other things that were happening in public health and some recommendations that were coming from, Department of Health and Human Services in North Carolina. So we made that difficult decision. I remember we packed up, we went home, and we didn't really know what was coming next. But for me, those first 2 weeks really felt... there was a lot of dissent that was happening. You know, what does this mean for the church? What does this mean for me as a pastor? What does this mean for the community that I'm called to serve when we can't be together? And I remember my realtor friend reached out and just said, hey, just checking on you, see how you're doing. And I'm like, I'm good. And how are you doing? You know, that lie, I'm good.
Right.
Yeah. I'm really not good. But tell me how you're doing. And her response was, well, I'm good. I'm still showing homes and people are still buying homes. And you know, we're fine. And for me, holding on to that is what got me through the next 2 or 3 weeks, because it was some sense of normalcy, even though it wasn't my normalcy. It was a sign. You know, it was like Noah when he sends a bird off and the bird comes back with a branch and it's like, yes, there's life somewhere.
Right.
And maybe not here, but somewhere. And that gives me hope. But when we're alone, we don't have that. And that is really devastating. Her, Joan's example from her own personal life is hearing from her superiors in religious life that she can't go to a graduate program for creative writing.
Right. Yeah.
And she names it really well. For a lot of people, that wouldn't be devastating. That would be disappointing. But for her, it was devastating because it was her entire future. And so I wonder if for us we can name some of those things. You know, what are those moments of crisis where your whole life, the whole future that you'd planned kind of fell apart, not by your own choosing or making, but just because. And I think that, like, just remembering those moments for ourselves might be an entry point into empathy and compassion here. But there really are different foundations upon which we each build our lives, hopes, dreams, professional identities, relational identities, religious identities. And then those things, they're so fragile, you know, they can be taken away. And
yes.
We're called to remember that our truest identity is not found in those things, but it's found in God's own self. And so we can talk about the gift of that later, because I haven't let you talk about the struggle of isolation. But let me leave that there.
I can't speak pastorally as you can, but as a parent and a grandparent and as someone who works at the church anyway, I get to minister in some ways.
Yes, you do.
Teaching Sunday school class and leading a men's fellowship a study kind of a thing. Hearing from my daughter about working at home and raising two young children, in a way, she's surrounded, but she feels isolated, I guess, in a sense, from the things that she's accustomed to that give her some release or relief. And there's a lot of ways that people connect with the world that they can't connect conveniently or comfortably with right now. And so I'm listening to people a lot, and I don't personally feel like I'm isolated, because I'm trying to be communicative and other things. But I know that many of my friends that are musicians are not working, and artists are struggling. Yeah. They're doing their own little podcasts or live events on Facebook or something like that. But they're And I mean, I communicate with them on Facebook, and I share their misery about all the gigs that got canceled, the shows that they can't play, and so forth. It's really tough for them. They're doing online lessons and trying to maintain as best they can, keep a stiff upper lip or whatever they're doing. But it's really tough for a lot of people.
Yeah. My sister's a wedding photographer, and I remember when, March is like the beginning of wedding season. And it was just cancellation after cancellation after cancellation. And, she's all heart, all feeling. And her first, legitimately, the first thing she said was, I'm just broken because all of these people are canceling their weddings. You know, how devastating is that? And then the flip side of that is, which I don't think she's even said, but I'm feeling for her is, you know, 50% of my income comes from wedding season.
Right.
And everybody's postponed for next year.
Well, I know. And it's a time for us to be sensitive to the needs of those that are unemployed, who are really struggling with those very essences of things of just getting by and struggling to exist, pay their bills. Certainly we need to be aware of that and pray for those folks. And we hope things will get restored.
Yeah. And give to them, right? Like if there's a service,
I think
we can continue to support.
Trying to, looking for opportunities to tip musicians here and there or something, you know, that are appearing and take care of that.
That's right.
And, mentioning family, we are getting together with our children and some of our grandchildren, this weekend, and we look forward to that. I don't know how we're going to, I think we're going to try to be as normal as we can, but this is a time that's, we waited through Easter and all those times and we didn't get together. And now we're trying to get together. We're just trying to return to normal and get rid of the isolation.
Yeah.
Part of what Joan Chittister teaches through the book is it's not always retreating to some safe place that gets us by. It's about working through the conflict and the struggle and the change to hopefully derive something to expand spiritually. You talked about expanding our spiritual things. You talked about living in a container, like we live in this container, but now the container is a little bigger and our spirituality hopefully is bigger, deeper, broader or something, but somehow we're changed through all these experiences. And I hope we get out on the other side of this pandemic. Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe better for the experience.
Yeah. One of my professors at Wake Forest Divinity School, her name is Dr. Jill Crenshaw, and she's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. You should follow her on social media. I remember first or second day with all of us new first years, walked into the classroom, and she wasn't carrying a physical suitcase, but she acted as if she were. She set this imaginary suitcase down on the table in front of us and opened it up and was talking us through what she was doing with her words. And she described seminary as one of these epic, life-changing struggles. And those are Joan's words applied to Jill's teaching. But I'll never forget the image. She said, you all come here carrying a full suitcase. You came here because you feel God's call in your life, and you've already got a full religious faith suitcase. And what you're going to do now is open it up and examine every single piece of it. And for some of you, it's going to feel like you turned it upside down and all of it came crashing out. For some of you, you're going to pick up each piece carefully and set it down and look at it. But all of you are going to empty the suitcase. And at some point, whether it's at the end of your 3 years or later in life or, at some point along the way, you're going to have to decide what goes back in. And some of that stuff is going to be new stuff. And some of that stuff you're going to have to leave on the table and walk away. And I think that's a powerful image of transformation. And for me, it was a ticket to independence, to bring us back to Joan's work and what she pairs with isolation as the gift of independence. She calls it a holy detachment, the gift of holy detachment. For me, it was permission to let go of the things that were not helpful, that were not life-giving, that were not helping me along the path of faith. And some of that was the rigidity of the Southern Baptist tradition that I was raised with. I said that I couldn't preach. I said that I couldn't teach if there were men in the room, said that I couldn't take dance lessons, which I'd done my whole entire life,
Right.
I couldn't eat shrimp, like all these things I like to do. And so I needed to leave them on the table. And there were some new tools that I picked up, which made me into a new person. And I know now that's called new creation, right?
Right.
And that's just one of the experiences of new creation from my story. But I think what Joan is calling us to do, Joan Chittister, author of the book, is to let ourselves become detached from all the pieces of layering that sometimes help us feel close to God, but they're not essential for being in relationship with God. We can talk about how that plays out in the church later, but I want to let you talk for a minute.
Well, you touched on holy indifference or holy detachment. Her statement, she makes several statements about that on page 35 of we're getting into the gift of independence, our counterpart.
We are.
We can go back because there's something I want to read about isolation again, too. But, but holy indifference, detachment, teaches me that there is no room for isolation, abandonment, death of the spirit when I lose one thing, because I know that there is something else waiting for me in its place. If only I can allow myself to watch for it, to wait for it, to grasp it when it comes. And so that holy indifference is a way of, it's hard to step out of your immediate situation because of the emotional swirl you may be in, the fear you feel, the isolation you feel, whatever it is, and in whatever circumstance you may be in. But it's kind of like connecting the experiences of your life. And maybe the longer and more experience you go in life and the more experiences you have that trouble you, you struggle through, you're able to do this better. I think maybe I'm certainly better at doing something like that now than I was 20, 30 years ago. Yeah. And I kind of get that feeling sometimes. It's not an easy feeling, but I think it's kind of necessary for us to kind of get through some of these changes.
Yeah. Let's go back to the isolation piece.
There were a couple of good things. You know, she did talk about how one struggle can color everything for us, and it kind of reality becomes blurred. This is on page 30. We live in our losses, our pain, our memories, our lost hopes. We run or we lean. Most of all, like children burned on a stove or animals subjected to shock collars, we take no chances now on anything that might hurt us the same way again. We shun love, fear organizations, stop our work, burn our plans, avoid the very things we love most, keep our distance from whatever might tempt us to try again, to begin over, to trust. Mm. Well, when I read that, I know that there are people that have passed through my life that I said, oh, yeah, well, that's true of so-and-so. I know that, yeah, they got burned one time. They don't want to have relationships, or they got burned in one job. They don't ever, you know, they withdraw. But then I look at myself and I think, you know, I think I might have reacted that way myself a time or two. So let's not be too judgmental.
Yeah.
Don't be judgmental at all. Yeah. But it's that temptation. And she says also on page 31, referring to this kind of thing, the spiritual response is too often a simplistic one. Either we abandon God or we blame God for abandoning us at times like this. I think she's talking about. And then at the end of the chapter on isolation, if we're going to move back to independence, she kind of closes that chapter with this. We find ourselves alone in a fragile world not of our own making, an unfriendly place where the sun no longer shines for us. What can possibly be the gift of such a state? It is the call out of isolation into independence. It is the grace of discovering that our lives are more than any one event, and that we, not fate, are really what will determine what the rest of our lives will be like.
Hmm.
Again, a reference to the holy indifference idea.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned just when you were quoting from page 31 about either abandoning God or blaming God for abandoning us, that I think is worth digging into. Because so often when we experience struggle or change or devastation or isolation, it feels like, I'm going to go with isolation primary, but all those things are related, but it feels like everybody and everything has abandoned us. We're alone. And we ask, where is God in the midst of all this pain? And it feels like we either blame God for the pain itself, or we blame God for leaving us. And I wonder if the question already leads to those two conclusions. Where is God in this? But I wonder if we just change the question word, who is God in this? How is God present? Or how is God in this struggle? To me, that opens up possibilities for an answer or a sense of assurance that is not an either or. It's not an I left you or you left me. It's a recognition that God could still be very present, even when God is not fixing or causing. But perhaps God is hovering over the chaos, just like in Genesis. Or maybe God is the partner we are wrestling, like in Jacob's story. Or maybe God is holding the whole earth and letting it quake with pain, just like in the crucifixion, just waiting for resurrection to happen. But I think when we only look at our struggles from a sense of isolation and we say, I am right here, this dot on the map, and where is God in my struggle? You know,
and I know that it's hard. She talks about how hard it is for people to relate and how we're ultimately dealing in that privacy of our own lives with this isolation, this feeling of isolation. Well, there's some personal responsibility for looking, for listening, for heeding advice. It may be well-meaning from others and a bit awkward, but to try to find in those some reassurances that others have experienced the same thing. I guess the underlying message is that everybody experiences these things. There's a universality of struggling and conflict that we all share. Sometimes we're just not good at relating to each other. And often God is working through us to guide other people through these experiences.
Yeah. That's so interesting to think about. It seems like sometimes when we're trying to relate to others, our go-to is to tell a story. You know, I'm hearing your story of pain, so now let me tell you my story of pain as a testament that you're going to get through this. It's all going to be okay because I got through mine, you know. And I wonder, I really think those questions are so important to help people process, you know, your world's falling apart. At that moment, it's not about my world or my experience of brokenness. It's about, how am I going to help you? How am I going to show you that I'm really listening and I'm really hearing what you're saying? And I think that asking people, how is God present with you right now? Or how is God absent with you right now? Because even in those moments, you can help people identify where they're putting God. You know, you mentioned that we don't know so much. We're not as good at identifying our own scabs. You know, we can point to others and be like, oh yeah, well that's trauma from her past or he got, you know, he got mad at that guy. So they're never going to get along. Sure. But me, I don't have any of that stuff. I'm good. You know, anyway, it's super complicated.
And I think Joan Chittister can say it better than I can. This calls for real discernment, spiritual discernment.
Yes.
So let me read a little bit about what she writes in addition to it. This kind of follows up on what we read a little earlier. Designed to enable a person to regard all of life with an open mind and a willing heart, detachment, holy indifference, is the foundation of spiritual discernment. To discern is to choose between available options on the grounds that both are good, but that one is more likely at this time to be preferable. It is the willingness to accept the idea that one option is more likely to result in greater growth at this particular time than can be expected from the other under these prevailing conditions, though both are good possibilities. Discernment and detachment are lifelines out of the pit of loss and the island of isolation to which it threatens to doom us. And detachment teaches us to let go. Of unwavering answers, let go of present achievements, let go of life's little hoard of trinkets.
Yeah.
Those are really good images.
They are.
All those false assurances. This is a time to kind of grow spiritually.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. When I read that this morning, I wrote down the phrase in my notes, when God closes a door, he opens a window.
Right.
And that's a phrase you probably will not hear me say most days. Not that I don't believe it. I just, you know.
That's from The Sound of Music, isn't it?
I don't know, but it's very anecdotal,
it's
right?
About Maria.
And, but I think as much as I might wrestle with the language of it and the idea that, you know, that the closed door is not something worth our grief. It is, but it's in line with what Chittister is saying about detachment and discernment. And just to be real specific about it, Christians have gathered in human bodies in a central location for 2,000 years, like since Jesus put his hand on Peter. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, theoretically, that's what we remember. And our practices of gathering and of worshiping God are very embodied. They like require us to be here in person, to hug, to shake hands, to pass bread, to pass offering plates, to hear a spoken word, to sing songs together. All that we do is very embodied. And I thought that was kind of like the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I really thought the gift the church had to offer our disembodied digital world was a human piece of engagement. And I can look at you in the eyes and say, I see your brokenness. Do you see mine? Is there space for that in the world? How can we hold each other up? Well, that door is shut right now. Mm-hmm. It might open again, but it's shut. And so we're having to, you know, I would never have called that a trinket. But what I've learned in the last 11 weeks is the church can still be the church, whether or not that door is closed. And that's a powerful, unwanted reality. So anyway, that's the gift of independence that I'm sensing now. I don't know about you.
Yeah, well, that's actually, it's giving us a chance to re-envision what church is. And it's maybe scary, but it's also liberating in a way.
Yeah.
And maybe it's... While we might, hopefully, we're going to return to the things, comfortable
the
things we've
again.
Always done, singing in the choir and things that I enjoy doing, and worshiping together in a body and kind of fellowship and all the good things with it. Yeah, I miss those. I miss them like crazy.
Yeah.
So church has to rethink itself during this time.
Yeah. There's... I know that we can talk about this probably for 3 more hours, but I want to send our folks to Joan Chittister's website because the book is really good. And I think Steve and I both agree the book is kind of just the beginning of Joan's amazingness. So her website is joanchittister.org. And I wonder, as we're remembering what is lost, as we're kind of lamenting that together, and we're deep in the throes of isolation, I wonder if we might end our conversation today with a prayer.
I'll be happy to read it for you, for us. This is Prayer for a Pandemic by Joan Chittister. God of light and God of mystery, give us the faith to see you in the gray dimness of this time. Give us the heart to hear, in the silence of the sick, the call to care for those in pain. Give us the courage to find you where you do not now appear to be. Give us the trust it takes to make our way through this uncertainty, this fear, this seemingly irredeemable sense of limitless loss, to the recognition of the relentless hope that each seasonal cycle of life confirms in us. You who made all things for our good and our growth, show us too now the power of darkness so that we might see newly beyond the ephemeral to what are really the gloriously important things in life. Amen.
Amen. Well, thanks for listening. And if you don't have the book, go get it. Scarred by Struggle, Transformed by Hope. And we'll see you next time when we talk about fear and courage.